you know, with Pound, you can read him without having any knowledge of classics or anything, because if you read more than a few cantos, you know what that name represents for him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a quality of behaviour or whatever. And so there's no need for explanation. Equally, if you do know a little bit, it makes it even richer.
Right.
And I wouldn't have that same pretension as my own work, because I don't interlace that sort of learning with it. Cause I don't have that.
So, really wanted to ask you, was, you said last night that you didn't make a distinction between poetry and prose.
Yeah.
That you sometimes wrote words which went right to the end of the margins, and sometimes you wrote shorter lines.
Yeah.
So, how do you decide if the words are going to go right to the end of the margin or not?
Well, it's all to do with notation. The way I see it is that I see myself as a writer who's making texts, not in the French sense of, sort of the new idea of pure language, but a piece of language and writing. And within that text, you're going to want to have various tones of voice, various speeds. And so the way you can convey this to a reader, as opposed to a listener, is by putting it down on the page in a certain way that will suggest that. And you see this in other writing. It's like Robert Creeley with his little short two or three words to a line, very short three or four line stanzas, accurately conveys the very sort of tense, abrupt way he reads those texts. And just the opposite line would be sort of like John Ashbery, who has these very long lines, who have almost like an anti-ending. They don't, you know, each line is in a unit. Makes you go on to the following one. So in fact, the poem could be written on one long strip of paper.
Yeah.
And that, again, accurately conveys his tone of voice when he reads, and the tone of voice soon he's trying to make in the poem, which is that of a slightly monotonous storytelling.
Storytelling.
You know, which goes on and on and on. But of course it isn't that simple story, but it's that sort of tone he's trying to get. And with myself, in say things like the Wish You Were Here pieces, the top parts are often set as what people call poetry, the set in short lines and spaced around to convey the way they're meant to sound. And the bottom bits, which were like comments on the top, are set as prose, because it goes from margin to margin.
Yeah.
And they are, the voice changes from the top to the bottom. It becomes it's just a straight narrative. I don't know if that explains it. The way I think the distinction between poetry and prose, certainly for me, and I think for most of my contemporaries, is a real division. It's no longer more meaningful. I mean, are Borges' short stories poems, or are they fiction?
Yeah.
And equally, are some of the long poems you get today, aren't they really sort of novels? There's no sort of camps anymore, thank God. And I'm very happy working like that.
The short line, you say Creeley uses it to get a certain terseness,
tension.
Do you sometimes use it to actually make that blank space after the words have ceased be a significant silence? You often have as it were, you note, you say something, you notate something, and then you don't complete the sentence. And one wants to actually have it looking towards a space or towards a silence.
Yeah, I don't know what significant silence sounds like. I don't mean to be that awesome, but I know what you mean. No, the short line, when I used it, when I have written various texts which are very bare, like sort of a few words just scattered around the page, are, you know, the idea is that you should just say the words which are a block, then a silence, then the next one. And hopefully the way you lay it on the page will suggest the length of silence and so on.
Mm.
And one can never notate completely accurately, you can try to hint at it. But the thing about leaving off a sentence halfway through, either just on the page just stops here, or I may use the technique of just three dots after the word. That's not to do just to do with silence. That's more pushing the listener to complete it. It's sort of hoping that the listener's sort of going along with you, or the reader's going along, and suddenly you step back and they have to keep running. And so sort of forcing them into collaborating in the poem. Mm. Well, a corny example. There's a poem of mine called Linen, I think it's in the beginning of Sinking Colony, where at the end the voice, the narrator in the poem, saying, the feel of skin, the touch, and it's like, and then there's a very sort of false start. Well, it's like so and so, and it's like, and the idea is, crudely, is that each of us has our own vivid symbol or idea of what a particular sensual experience is like. You know, it's soft as silk, soft as velvet, soft as a flower, soft as a cat's fur, whatever. And so, if a person puts in their own personal sort of symbols or whatever, the text becomes a shared text much more. It's something you do, you make the poem together, which, without being doctrinaire, it's ties in the idea of always having a work, well, not always, but certainly for the last 10, 15 years, of a basic insistence on respect for other people, for one's reader. And a refusal to move towards that thing of poet as guru, poet as preacher, which I find completely obnoxious. And the idea of, which is the one of the sad sides of the Beats. I mean, the Beats opened so many doors and started things, but there's a quality of the ranter in the Beat poets which sort of got somebody by the lapel to listen by the lapel and said, listen, I'm going to tell you where it's at, man. And nobody can tell you where it's at because we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of counteracting that. I think Ashby, I think I learned the trick from Ashby. He did that. So, well, it was close to that, you know, sort of using disjointed and broken off sentences, which, again, when all these things connect, of course, is a far more accurate notation of thought, because we don't think in grammatical sentences or straight lines. We sort of jump around, which is just as in, well, certainly in English conversation. People in England, I'm not sure about France, but certainly it's the language you use and the culture you live in, when talking about a thing, go round and round and round.
You do in France too.
Yeah, and you suggest various qualities, and it's a way of communicating, which isn't obvious, whereas another kind of thing we say in America, because there's this big stress in the schools on, what's the word for it? Being able to express yourself well, clearly. Verbal skills or whatever.
Communication studies?
Yes. And so you have a conversation. I'm thinking of the Creeley and various other people, where one person says something. It says, right, So the audience, we all agree on this point. Bang, nail in there. Right. Yeah. Next step. Yeah. So. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Next step. And so sort of this incredibly rigid thing goes on, and then suddenly after a while, if you're following this along, you're very impressed by it because it seems so self-confident.
Yeah.
And it's very refreshing if you live in a sort of a complex, muddled society to come across this sort of straight, simple. But then you suddenly say, well, but. And you find yourself, you've been totally carried along with this, and then you really think, well, I shouldn't be, you know, I don't agree with that. That's being absurdly crude. Which is, echo that lovely quote by, you know, the enforcer thing on Jede's death.
Don't
know
it.
Well, I haven't got it. It's in The Long Black Veil.
Oh,
I think
it's about
book six. It's where after Xi died, Forster wrote a memorial piece in some magazine, and talk about Xi's joy in the complexity of life and the importance of registering this complexity. Because that was where the, you know, that was what made us human, that's what the pleasure was.
Another question?
Yes.
How do you combine the art of telling a story, just keeping the audience kind of hanging on the some kind of narrative line, with what you've just said about trying to register complexities? Is there a tension there?
There can be. I'm not sure how much it's to do with the actual text. I'd love to be a fiction writer, a prose writer, a novelist. and I feel very frustrated in that because I don't have that skill. Mind you, it's always the grass is green on the other side, because successful novel writers, I mean, think of science fiction writer Tom Dish. I think of my friend Tony Lopez, who had quite a successful career as writing hack novels.
Yes, and
Jack
Nicholson.
Yeah. Always wanted to write poetry.
Yeah.
And certainly myself, and would love to be able to write novels. I mean, I'd love to be able to write something like a Robert Louis Stevenson novel. I haven't written Treasure Island. Or, I mean, write a book that grips you, that you don't put down. You just read on and on and on. You're not reading culture, you're not reading literature. You're completely absorbed in this thing. And every so often a book like that comes your way and transcends all the self-conscious ideas of, well, I better read this because of, you know, I must keep up. It's absurd. And what I think pleasure is essential. In Borgeson's system, pleasure must be essential in literature. So, oh, that's a long way for your question. But I would love to be able to write clear, direct stories, but I can't. But what I do write is much more like a collage. And I realise that, especially if somebody's listening to it, it's difficult to take in sometimes, even if you're very attentive. So it's encouraging to know that you may read sometimes and get this rather confused look from people listening. And if by chance you meet somebody a couple of days later, they say, right, yes. Kind of, they thought about something you'd say which they weren't clear about. And then it had like a chemical dropped in into a substance. It had gradually come to the surface. It had hit them in that very indirect way, as opposed to the direct way of saying, listen, I'm going to tell you where it's at. I've seen the best minds of our generation destroyed their minds.
Yes.
I can't do anything about that. I mean, I know it's difficult at times. I know at other times it isn't difficult. But I certainly am never intentionally obscure. But there are various things which you just cannot put in a straight narrative way. you have to do by jumping from one thing to the other.
Yeah.
And hoping that the sum of these is the story itself. Mm.
Just mentioned Ginsberg.
Mm.
What did you learn from the Beats? I mean, you classified yourself perhaps as a Beat poet at one stage, or one of the Beats.
No. I think we were talking about Brian last night. I said, you see all the people moved away and you're left there, you feel you're like the original aging hippie in a remote provincial town here.
Yeah.
I think when I was about 1920, I came across Kerouac and Ginsberg books. And,
Sorry, 19?
Oh, about 1960.
Yeah.
And, they're incredible release.
Mm.
Because before that I'd read, I like poetry, I'd written bad poetry, bad verse. But you had this, in England anyway, you had this idea that the only thing that could be good must be somebody who's dead. Like, I was very interested in Tristan Tzara and started translating his work.
Mm.
I thought he must be dead. Then I found a French Who's Who and I found he was alive, you know, incredible, you know. So I went to see him at once. But, well, I mean, it's sociology, really, isn't it? It's the Beats, for so many people in England, were like they opened the door. They said that you too can write. You know, you don't have to have gone to a public school and Oxford and Cambridge to be before you can write. Anybody can write. It is like giving you self-confidence.
Mm.
But that's not the real thing to it. It was reading on the road, reading Howell, and for the first time in your life, picking up a printed book where people were talking about the world you knew, that you lived in, and was expressing what you felt were your feelings, confused and gauche as they may have been at the time. And so there's an immense sort of surge of confidence that came from this in your own feelings, in your own worth, and in your own powers to make things. And so you had a whole mass of people like Jim Burns and Dave Cunliffe and Chris Torrance and others in this country just writing these apocalyptic poems and so on and so on. And pouring stuff out and printing their own magazines and distributing. And a big thing of an interchange with the US magazines, sort of sending them to one another, going and visiting one another and so on. And none of these people ever had gone to university. It was very different to the Americans, because in fact nearly all the Beat poets were graduates.
Right.
I was here, I remember certainly then, I was the only person of that whole network other than Horowitz, who'd been to university, and I certainly hid it very much. I meant to go to university, and it was very wrong, didn't it? And it was a type of C&D, and all that. I mean, you know the Nuttall's book, Bomb Cultures, it catches quite a bit of that. It was it's political, it's a class thing, it was a working class thing. I suppose finding the secondary education, which started up in the 1940s with the Labour government, bore its fruit. Those people who would never have before dreamed they could be allowed to write. And of course, in 1960 and 61, 62, and a bit later, 60, you know, not only did you know if you sent your work to publishers like Faber or to the literary magazines that were accepted then, they wouldn't want to know at all.
Which is still the case.
Yeah. You wouldn't even think of sending them to them because you wouldn't want to be published by them.
Yeah,
you just wouldn't make them associate. It was a completely new thing. It was a...
You said that one of the major things is learning to have confidence in expressing your own feelings. But that in later the Beats became rather ranters telling people how to live.
Yeah.
Do you think one of the important things in... I mean, it seems to me one of the important things for you is actually finding a poetry which can respect the individual's feelings.
Yes. And the individual's intelligence.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the other things which was annoying about when you sort of thought more about what happened with the Beats was, one, the totally phony premise which they established, which was sincerity equal quality.
Mm.
It isn't true. I mean, Calvin was sincere. Mm. And he was a monster. Hitler was sincere.
Mm.
But there was a time that if you felt it, then it was great literature, which is crazy. But at the time, it served its purpose to get people going.
Mm.
Now, the other thing... I lost it.
Can I ask you something else then?
Yeah, it's just... what did you do? No, one of the sad thing I felt about Beats was that after this sort of great opening of doors, like sort of Bakunin, you raise the ground and then you build again. Instead of like living in the open at last, which is so exciting, the windows open, they immediately grab new orthodoxies to replace the old orthodoxies. So you knock down these sort of the button-down American Baptist thing. And you become an Indian religious freak.
Mm.
Or some other orthodoxy is very, very depressing that.
Mm.
Anyway, yeah.
I don't know if it directly relates, but somehow I have an intuitive feeling it ought to. The fact that a lot of your poetry is, or perhaps some of the recent stuff especially, what one might call, without being at all patronising in the best sense, occasional. Verse,
yeah.
Like the postcards with Tony Lopez and now writing posters.
Mm.
Now, does that have behind it some sort of sense of the importance of, if you want, the commonplace in people's lives? You know, this is what our lives are constructed of as opposed to some moral principle. I mean, this is, as it were, the texture of our lives.
I don't, well, that's so conscious. I don't think of my work as those particular poems as being occasional. I also associate occasional verse with being poems written for a specific occasion, for the birth of something or to celebrate a particular event, or which I have written, say in Boston, Brighton. There's quite a number of poems I've had, a visit to Walden Pond.
Mm.
But those, especially the Wish You Were Here, thing is, certainly a year or more's work on that, and the actual texts are not about specific occasions, they're fictions.
Yes, they're fictions, but I mean, in that case, I would say the postcards were
the
occasion.
Yes. Oh, you mean the thing of collaborating?
Or the thing of having a, what might it be, a woodprint or a sepia postcard or something to which the text is somehow related, even though rather kind of loosely, fictionally.
I know there's a principle, it's just the way I work now. I found that I haven't got it here. It's as though in one's career as a writer, I don't mean that in a pompous way, but you've written for so many years, you've got so many books under your belt.
Yeah.
There becomes a point when you've really written out all the material which you base on memory and so on, and feelings. And of course you can continue writing that sort of material, but it becomes rather like faded carbon copies.
Yeah.
Is as though at that point you must sort of get off and move beyond that into being a maker.
Yeah.
And at that point, you are making fictions, which for me is very exciting. I think Ashbery has this too.
Yeah.
Well, much greater than mine, but whereby he gives you a text which is not obviously got his thumbprint at the bottom. You know, you can recognise it's John Ashbery, but on the other hand, it's not saying this is about John Ashbery.
Mm.
It's as though he's giving you this lovely puzzle which you can read and turn over and use, and then you can pass it to somebody else. And that's what I'd like to do, to make texts that have that give people that pleasure, and also deal with subjects that concern me, rather than using poetry as self-expression, which we were talking about earlier. You know, how you begin writing almost like purely for reasons of self-expression, and then move more and more towards being a maker.
And you also, going with being a maker for people.
Mm.
Earlier on, you were talking about the listener rather than the reader.
Yeah.
Is it actually important to you to come give poetry readings as opposed to simply throw the thing out into the airwaves and see what happens, or never know what happens?
Yeah, I not too many readings, but I do. I think readings are very important. It's a final way to test a work.
Mm.
It's if it doesn't sound right, it isn't right. That's it.
Mm.
Because if it's notation, therefore it is primarily to be spoken, and therefore the text must be read aloud to be realised.
Mm.
Not that can be the only way to approach it. You also want then maybe people go back in their own, the quiet of their own homes, to read the text as well. But they're both very important.
Mm.
The thing about collaborating with postcards is it's a lovely way of pushing you into areas that you might not have gone otherwise. You want to touch. Mm. So for instance, yeah, I mean, you've got to pick very carefully who you work with. I've tried collaborations with people that didn't work. I tried working with Alan Fisher, who I like very much as a person, but we just didn't have the same temperament.
Yeah.
Whereas Tony and I share a lot. And so he sent me a card, and I just look at the card in front of my desk and start imagining a story. But the story would be my story, but equally it would be sparked off by seeing a scene I would never have otherwise seen, like the cover of the issue we're here, that hotel balcony near Grimsel. Suddenly you can imagine all sorts of wonderful things happening on the balcony. And so I find collaborating with people that are the right temperament is immensely useful for me.
Mm.
And why not?
It breaks down that whole notion of the artist as the kind of solitary.
Oh, yes. And of course he isn't. I mean, if an artist can be defined as anything, he's a thief. you're continually begging and borrowing and stealing from other people, other texts. The idea of originality seems one of the most sort of absurd ideas. It's just not true. I mean, not true for anybody. I mean, look what food you like. And all your favourite dishes are given, associated with one person that introduced you to them.
Mm.
And music's the same.
Mm.
I mean, I would never have got to liking Schubert if I hadn't moved before then. So, and so my whole musical library is associated with people.
Yeah. Right. Should I switch off at that point?
Maybe.
That's great.